morning. A delight to welcome everyone to the courtroom, but especially Tenor High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. High school students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they're given materials about this case, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come to an oral argument. A member of the court is assigned to speak with the students who come, and this is done after the second oral argument today. The discussion centers on the procedures of the court in accepting cases and hearing and deciding cases. The discussion is not on the substantive issues in the case. Everyone is invited to join with the students and the justice during this lunch hour discussion. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. While she's doing that, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, with whom you will meet at the end of this oral argument. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To Justice Crooks's left is Justice Pat Robensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case today, 09 AP 2752, Michelle Wodzinski versus Auto Owners Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of the Auto Owners Insurance Company will be Arthur Kurtz, who has 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Kurtz.
Thank you, distinguished members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, counsel, and guests to today's proceedings. The issue before the court is one of insurance policy interpretation. Specifically, there will be two issues that I believe the court needs to address in order to render its decision. One is whether Auto Owners Insurance Policy Company, in issuing this umbrella or executive umbrella policy, was allowed not to provide UM or uninsured motorist coverage as part of its policy, and if the court decides that UM coverage need not have been required as a matter of law, then the issue is whether the policy in fact provided UM coverage for this particular loss, considering the fact that the umbrella policy at issue contains a clear grant of coverage which provides third-party liability only. The policy contains no mention of UM coverage in either its declarations page or anywhere else in the policy, and where it contains an exclusion expressly excluding coverage for personal injury to an insured or a relative. The facts of the case are straightforward. Stephen Wodzinski was tragically killed in a motor vehicle accident in 2006 caused by an uninsured motorist. There is no dispute about that. Three policies were issued. Two were issued to his company, Picard Chemical, one being a commercial automobile policy, which contained a $150,000 limit for UM coverage. The second was a commercial umbrella policy issued to Picard Chemical as well, That policy is not in dispute in this particular matter. And the third is the executive umbrella policy, which was issued personally to Mr. Wodzinski. It is undisputed that auto owners paid the full $150,000 policy limits required under the commercial umbrella policy to the plaintiffs in this case.
And the under the commercial auto policy.
Correct.
Not umbrella.
That is correct. It's the underlying policy or one of the underlying policies. That is correct.
And the commercial umbrella had a specific exclusion relating to UM.
There is a specific exclusion for UM coverage for that particular policy. The case went before the circuit court on both policies. The court found, and I believe prior to the actual decision by the circuit court, I believe the plaintiffs did acknowledge that the commercial umbrella policy did not provide UM coverage, but they proceeded to make the claim against the particular policy at issue in this case, which is the executive umbrella policy. The circuit court found that there was no UM coverage under the executive umbrella policy. The Court of Appeals reversed, and this court accepted the petition for review filed by auto owners. I will take very little time to address the first issue, is whether an insurance company that issues umbrella or excess policy is required to provide UM coverage in such a policy. The answer, in our opinion, is no, and that would be based on the workings of two one statute and one administrative code. The statute being Section 631.015, which the Wisconsin legislature ruled or held or has a law which states that the commissioner of insurance may by rule exempt any class of insurance contract or insurer from any or all of the provisions of this chapter and Chapter 632. If the interests of Wisconsin's insureds or creditors or the public of the state do not require such regulation. In response to that, the Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner enacted Administrative Code Insurance Section 6.77 in parentheses 4A, which provides that any umbrella policy or excess liability insurance policy is exempt from the requirements of 632.324, which is the requirement for UM coverage. The court in Eder recognized and reaffirmed the right of the umbrella carrier not to provide UM coverage, and I believe that there is no basis that has been presented to this court to overrule that finding. The second issue is the one I believe that the court is more interested in determining for clarity within the state for insureds and insurers alike, and that is whether this particular policy, the auto owner's executive umbrella policy, does provide or did provide coverage, excess UM coverage. And the key to any policy, and I will go over some of the rules of policy interpretation that I think are directly impacted by this case and which the court should use as guidance in its ultimate decision in this case. And I will do that before I actually start talking about the policy provisions itself, because in essence, every policy is different. Unlike the prior argument where one of the counsel says, well, they're all about the same, they're very similar, that in case is not particularly true. They have similar provisions, but the language is different. If they were all the same, maybe most of us would not be in this court today. So we recognize that.
Counselor, in your view,
yes,
would the policy function the same way as you are arguing that it does if it didn't have the exclusion that we've all focused on, the one that is labeled exclusion of personal injury to insureds following form and then the two-sentence statement afterwards? If it didn't have that at all, a part of the policy? Would it function the same way that you're telling us it functions?
Yes, it would. I would argue that if that exclusion was not there, there would still be no grant of coverage for UM anywhere in the policy, and it would not provide any coverage.
Then why is it there? Why do we need it?
Why it's there? It's there for additional clarification. And I believe that it does clarify the fact that there is no coverage for an insured or a relative. So I think it's there for clarification. Do I believe that every insurance policy is perfect in its wording? Absolutely not. But when you look at the language of the policy and apply the rules of policy interpretation, I believe that it's clear that this policy is not ambiguous and does not provide UM coverage for this particular loss.
Counsel, your comments prior to Justice Rokensack's question was queuing up the question that I've had in my mind from the get-go when we first took this case, and that is the language of the exclusion referred to by Justice Rokensack, the exclusion of personal injury to insureds following form, and then that's contained in the appendix on page 31. From the get-go, I thought, boy, this seems kind of like a unique provision. So my question is this a form, does this exclusion of personal injury to insureds following form, have you ever seen this being used verbatim, these words and this heading, in any other insurance company's policy?
Having worked for a Progressive Insurance Company for 10 years before practicing law, I've had an opportunity to look at multiple policies in multiple settings. I don't know if there's any – I can't say that there's any policy that contains exact verbiage to this particular endorsement. However, there are very similar endorsements used in multiple policies, including some of the policies cited by both parties in the briefs, the key cases, the Mullenbeins, the Etter, the Stubbe, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, and Broder.
You know, there are resources, treatises, that the insurance industry has that these are the, if you will, form policies, F-O-R-M, form policies, and that a lot of insurance companies, in part because of the safety of using these forms policies, sometimes these provisions have been tried and tested in courts already. And so there's a real safety in using this uniform language. And indeed, when we look at insurance policies, you can see the initial grant of coverage oftentimes is just the same regardless, that language, regardless of what company issues the policy. This seems pretty unique to me. And I'm just wondering if my hunch is correct that you aren't able to tell me of any other company. Certainly the concept is there, but these words, does any other company that you know of has used these words for this concept?
I can't state to the court that there's an exact replica of that particular exclusion in any other policy. I don't necessarily believe that's at all determinative of this case, but I will not say to this court there's an exact replica policy. I think that the intent of that policy, the language of the policy, and the reasonable interpretation of that policy is very similar to other similar exclusions that are contained in umbrella policies. When I look at and what I believe that some of the key rules of policy interpretation that I think are implicated in this particular case are the ones that this court is very familiar with, but I just want to briefly go over some of them as well. When a policy is clear and unambiguous, it should not be rewritten by construction to bind an insurer to a risk never contemplated or intended to be covered. And that's citing from the Bloom case. Again from the Bloom, the court's focus is on the reasonable insured's expectation of coverage in view of the policy as a whole. Therefore, proper consideration of both the purpose of the type of coverage at issue and the kind of coverage a reasonable person in the position of the insured would inspect when the policy must be viewed. Any ambiguity must be genuine. A policy is not rendered ambiguous anytime an insured is able to conjure up an interpretation that is grammatically plausible and creates coverage, citing from State Farm and Langridge. The court cannot use headings of a policy to create ambiguities. And to be contextually ambiguous, a policy must build up false expectations, contain internally inconsistent provisions, or be so deceptive that it befuddles the understanding and expectations of a reasonable insured. Again, from Blum. Exceptions to an exclusion cannot create coverage that was never granted in the policy's initial insuring clause, and that's from the Jatterborg decision. And industry terms of art cannot create an ambiguity because courts must interpret policies in light of reasonable expectations of the insureds, and that's from the Doyle case. Let's take a look at this particular policy. And the policy is obviously attached to our appendix in our case in brief. I would begin with what is typically called and specifically called the grant of coverage, which is on page 23 of our appendix, page 3 of this particular policy. And the section is under coverages, and the title involved of that is personal liability. And it provides, we will pay on behalf of the insured the ultimate net loss in excess of the retained limit, which the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of personal injury or property damage, which occurs anywhere in the world. That is a clear grant of third-party liability coverage in excess of the underlying policies.
Well, you know, your original page 21 says this policy applies to personal injury and property damage which occur during the policy period. It doesn't say personal injury to third parties or personal injury to you. It just says it's general. Then the coverage is personal liability, which is third party, right? But then you've got where does it say that they don't cover personal injury to the insured? That comes up later, right?
Well, that is true. I believe you are reading the insuring agreement, which is page 1 of the policy, a little more broadly than it should be read.
Well, maybe so, but it says what I say it says. Namely, it doesn't say whose personal injury or whose property damage.
It indicates that we agree to provide insurance subject to all the terms of the policy.
Right. It says, as shown in the declarations.
Right.
So yep. Now we have to have a declaration that says it doesn't cover injury to the insured.
Well, if you look at the declarations page for this particular policy.
Right. What is it?
Talks about, again.
What page is that?
That would be on page 19 of the appendices.
Yep, I read that. And then what does that do?
It talks about limits of liability.
And that doesn't tell us, too, whether the other party is liable to me or I'm liable to them. Okay.
I don't think that's a fair reading of what the deck page says. I think limits of liability in a policy of this talk about when you talk about what liability is covered under the policy, mm-hmm. It is liabilities to third parties. I think that the crux...
I understand that that's the insurance company's argument,
understood.
And I'd make it too if I were the insurance company.
It appears that the crux of this case really revolves around the exclusion of personal injury to insurance following form endorsement, which is on page 31 of the appendix.
Okay.
And
that's where we get to personal injury to the insured, right?
That is correct.
All right.
And it states in its first sentence, we do not cover personal injury to you or a relative. Second sentence appears to be the sentence upon which the plaintiffs in this case are relying on for the determination that the policy is ambiguous and therefore should provide UM coverage. We will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided by an underlying policy listed in Schedule A. Mm-hmm. Turn to Schedule A, which is on page 20 of the appendix, which is page 2 of the policy. And in the middle section that is bracketed, it says Schedule A, and it specifies what the insurance company is requiring as underlying, from the underlying policy. A, comprehensive personal liability with a $300 minimum primary limit. B, auto liability with a $500,000 limit. There is no other coverage that is discussed as being required in Schedule A, and that does not include any reference whatsoever to UM coverage.
Yeah, but it says underlying carrier schedule. What does that mean? Auto owners insurance company, owners insurance company.
Those are the two companies that issued the policies under which the required coverages were provided. A is auto owners insurance company for the comprehensive personal liability, mm-hmm. and B, owners insurance company, which is a sister company or one of the companies under the auto owners umbrella.
Did either one of those policies, especially the comprehensive personal liability, have uninsured motorist coverage?
One did.
Right.
It had $150,000 separate limits, not liability limits, UM limits.
Right. So you said there's no reference to uninsured motorists, and I'm saying to you, I see a reference to it because I know that this comprehensive personal liability does cover uninsured motorist. And it says B, auto liability, which says to me, hey, most or many insurance, auto insurance, cover UM and UIM because, you know, the statutes keep changing. But at least at one time, the insurance company has to advise the insured they can get this kind of coverage, right?
That is a current requirement.
Right. So, you know, I see uninsured motorist subliminally in here.
Subliminally does not create, in my opinion, an ambiguity.
All right. Counsel, I want to follow on that. First of all, it's the automobile liability policy that I think has the 150 UM coverage. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct.
Okay. Then I want to take, this is Schedule A. I want to go back to page 31, which is the exclusion that's really the focus of our inquiry today. And it, of course, makes reference to Schedule 1. Now, it's just not reference to Schedule 1. You've got page 31 of the appendix. It's just not reference to Schedule 1. The heading says this is following form. Now, generally, following form means, generally, incorporated in an umbrella policy. There are following form umbrella policies. And when you have following form umbrella policies, it means, in essence, the underlying policy is incorporated into the umbrella and the terms and all of the conditions as if set forth fully therein in the umbrella policy. Generally, your understanding, am I correct on that? And I see you nodding for the record.
I'm nodding that I understand your comment.
Okay, but is my comment generally correct? I mean, because maybe I'm wrong. I mean, that's, in these following form, it means just that you don't have to rewrite all of the provisions of the underlying policy and your umbrella policy. You incorporate as is set forth in full.
If that was a correct interpretation, Your Honor, then there would be no reason to limit or to list on Schedule A the liability limits of the two particular policies.
So what does this following form mean in your exclusion of personal injury to insureds following form? What I gave you, what was my understanding having written decisions on this, of what the following form generally means. What does following form mean on page 31 of this endorsement? Whoever wrote this, what was it intended to mean?
I believe what was intended to be meant by this particular endorsement was a limitation of coverage to only that is specifically limited to or referenced to in Schedule A.
So how does this page 31 define, how do you define, and the Court of Appeals asked the same question. It says, if I recall correctly, in paragraph 25 and 26, it talks about the following form language and says in paragraph 26, auto owners had opportunity to explain what meaning in its brief in an oral argument, but failed to offer any explanation. So here's your chance. What does following form mean as used on page 31 in this exclusion?
One is my recollection of the oral argument was slightly different than was set forth in the decision, in that I did argue the same as I've argued here, that to the extent that it is following the form of Schedule A, that it only provides and discusses liability limits, not UM limits, and that's what I explained to the court. As the court wrote its decision. I'm not going to state anything else. Furthermore, in one of the last rules of insurance policy interpretation that I cited is that terms of art like following forms cannot create an ambiguity because the courts are to interpret a policy in light of the reasonable expectations of the insured. What is undisputed and can't be disputed because the court has a full policy in front of it, is that in this particular policy, the words uninsured motorists are completely absent. They're absent from the declarations page. They're absent from Schedule A. They're absent from the policy. And in looking at the cases that we cite in our brief in support of our position, other umbrella UM cases, we believe that there is no basis when you apply the insurance policy construction rules to this particular policy that a reasonable insured, and therefore this court, should have had a reasonable expectation that there would be excess UM coverage. I don't believe that this policy creates anything that is builds up expectations of such coverage when there's no language that is deceptive in any way, shape, or form, so that coverage would be afforded. I think it's really important when we look at these cases to look at some of the language of the cases and the other policy provisions in those particular cases. And I'd like to start with, and maybe end with, since my light just turned red.
Yes, and so you've got a couple of moments to sum up.
Understood. I believe that unlike the Stubbe case, where there's three specific references to UM coverage in the policy and deck page, including an endorsement that says that the uninsured motorist exclusion is deleted in its entirety, that it is completely understandable and distinguishable from the facts in this case. When you look at Muhlenberg, Etter, and Broder for its persuasive value, it's not a published case, I believe the court, in looking at the auto owner's policy, will find that it does not provide any excess UM coverage. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel, and you have 5 minutes in
thank you.
George Burnett, representing Michelle Wodzinski.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent the Wodzinski family in connection with this case. Let me begin by departing from a prepared argument address some of the points that Mr. Kurtz made and some of the questions from the court. First of all, I have great respect for Mr. Kurtz, but we disagree on what the preliminary issue is before this court. There is no question before this court, because the plaintiff has not advanced the argument that the insurance commissioner was without power to promulgate 6.77 of its regulations. We don't claim that auto owners had to offer UM coverage in this umbrella policy. We don't claim that because it's not necessary to our position.
So you accept that this policy, if it said explicitly, we are not insuring under this umbrella UM, you wouldn't be here?
I wouldn't be here, not because that would be a correct legal premise, Your Honor, but as a matter of legal strategy, for lack of a better term. What auto owners did here was they conferred UM coverage on the Wozinski family.
Well, so I went through the statutes and I went through the administrative code, and I thought that when you looked at the applicable dates here, that the commissioner had issued a ruling saying, hey, you don't have to cover it under umbrella. But that's been changed, and there are new rules and different rules, but there's a question of whether they're retroactive.
Well, the dates are important, Your Honor, not for that subject, but because of a different argument auto owners advances later. The short indication, the fact is that 6.77 of the administrative regulations didn't apply to this policy. The policy was issued in April of 06, expired in April of 07, and in June of 07, 6.77 took effect. So that's important because that is one of the explanations that auto owners has offered in response to Justice Rogensack's question, why is this endorsement here? On a reply brief and a new argument that we had not seen before in this case, auto owners told the court Section 6.77 applies to this policy, and we promulgated this endorsement to confirm that. That just can't, the dates don't match. It can't possibly be accurate. So that's a long way of saying we don't take the position attributed to us on that first issue. Justice Bradley asked whether this is a unique form or whether it is something that we'll see in garden variety umbrella policies or primary policies. It is clearly a unique form. It's missing the ubiquitous ISO copyright on the bottom, the copyright the insurance services office promulgates when the industry uses standard form. It's especially unique because of the following form language that's in the heading to the policy. There is no other policy, at least that I've encountered, that talks about following form. And that's important for the reasons that Justice Bradley was alluding to, because following form has a very specific and well-established meaning in the insurance world.
Mr. Burnett, what is your response to Mr. Kurtz's argument that the heading may not be used to create ambiguity where none otherwise would exist, and following form in this instance appears in the heading?
It's an interesting argument because it contradicts another argument made by auto owners in the case, and they say coverage cannot be created by an exclusion. Well, and they point to the exclusion language in the heading and say, well, that settles the question. So to the extent that headings cannot create ambiguity, and I think they can, the Court of Appeals points out very clearly that headings are part of a policy, and if a heading provides direction, and if it misdirects the reasonable policyholder reading this policy, that creates an ambiguity. What Mr. Kurtz, I think, is what the correct premise of law is, that when there is a conflict between a heading and the text of a policy, the text controls.
As to the reasonable insured understanding the phrase following form, I know this was addressed in the briefs, but I'd like to hear your position now as to why a reasonable insured, unschooled in the terminology and the terms of art connected with the insurance industry, would read following form as to provide coverage.
Following form, I'm going based on intuition more than any empirical knowledge. Following form must mean something. And when you read it in connection with what the policy says, what it describes in that very important second sentence, we will cover such injury to the extent that insurance, a key word, is provided by an underlying policy listed in Schedule A. That is a classic statement of a following form provision. We don't say this is a following form policy. We say this is a following form endorsement. I couldn't have said that better.
Counselor, if I were to ask you the same question but a little different that I asked opposing counsel, if this policy did not contain the exclusion that we've all been talking to on page 31, is it your position it would still provide underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage here?
My position is lawyerly probably not. And the reason I say that is this, that I think there are major problems with this policy and what it informs policyholders and more specifically what it doesn't tell them. So the format of this policy, for example, is highly atypical. You go to the title page, if it's a liability policy, wouldn't you expect to see words to the effect umbrella liability policy or executive umbrella liability policy? The title page doesn't provide that. If you go to the table of contents, it doesn't indicate that there's no UM coverage here. If you go to the declarations page, it is completely silent on the coverages it provides and the coverages it doesn't provide. If you go to the insuring agreement, which the Chief Justice read, again, there's no mention of UM coverage.
Now, sir, just given the fact that your answer is it probably wouldn't cover UM, then you are essentially asking us to apply an exception to an exclusion to make coverage, aren't you? And how does that bear on the decision in Janderborg?
I'm not asking you to apply an exception to an exclusion because it's not an exclusion.
Well, it's, right across the top it says exclusion of personal injury to insureds.
If
you do not cover, I mean, I don't know what would you call that.
I would call that an endorsement. And the reason I would call it an endorsement is that's what Auto Owners has called it. If you look at page 64 of our appendix, volume one of our appendix, and I reproduced it because this is the policy as it was provided to the Wodzinski family, what you'll see is you'll see a punitive damages endorsement. That's their words, following form endorsement. Then you see exclusion of personal injury to insureds, following form. They call that an exclusion. Then you'll see pollution liability, following form. They don't call that either an exclusion or an endorsement. And then if you go to page 66 of our appendix, you'll see a bodily injury following form endorsement. Now let's read the bodily injury following form endorsement on page 66. It says, we agree the following exclusion is added. We do not cover bodily injury to passengers while occupying or getting off a motorcycle, moped, etc. We will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided by an underlying policy as listed in Schedule A. In language and in meaning, that endorsement is no different than the personal injury exclusion that Auto Owners and we are here about today. My ultimate point is this is not an exclusion for a couple of reasons. Number one, it grants coverage. We will cover, can do nothing else. Number two, Auto Owners is at best arbitrary on how they use the words exclusion and how they use the words endorsement. I have pointed out those other passages because on punitive damages and pollution liability, their endorsements have exactly the same effect.
Counselor, you aren't suggesting, though, that insurance policies often do not use endorsements to show exclusions from coverage.
No, I'm not. I think an endorsement is another word for an amendment.
Right.
And it's important because it supersedes what goes before in the main manuscript, the primary policy. So that's important in connection with this case because this endorsement supersedes the coverage passage that Mr. Kurtz read earlier. It supersedes that coverage passage because the coverage passage says we will pay on behalf of the insured the ultimate net loss, and it goes on to talk about because of personal injury, which the insured is legally obligated to pay. The insuring agreement, which the Chief Justice read, indicates that the auto owners provides insurance subject to all the terms of the policy, not just that coverage section. And then the endorsement uses the word, we will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided by an underlying policy listed in Schedule A. The insurance provided by an underlying policy listed in Schedule A includes UM coverage. It is more than it was more than just subliminally provided in that coverage in the declarations page. UM coverage in this state, as the court is well aware, is mandatory, at least in a primary policy. This was a primary policy. So if we're talking about the insurance, this primary underlying policy provided, UM coverage was mandatory. There is no basis to say that auto owners picked and it chose among the various coverages provided in that policy.
Mr. Burnett, let me ask you a question, and I'll tell you what's troubling me in this particular situation. We normally look at a policy as a whole. We look at reasonable expectations of an insured. When I look at this policy as a whole, not breaking down all of the provisions, this appears to me to be a executive umbrella policy aimed at protecting Mr. Wodzinski from liability over and above underlying insurance. And it seems to me that when I look further at this policy as a whole, I never see mentioned any place UM coverage or UIM coverage. So the conclusion for me seems to be this is an umbrella policy protecting Mr. Wodzinski. It doesn't mention any UM coverage directly. It doesn't mention UIM coverage. Isn't the reasonable expectation of an insured looking at this policy, this is third-party liability coverage for me. It's not coverage that provides for a recovery for me or my estate under UM or UIM. What's wrong with that reasoning?
It's not a fair characterization of the reasonable expectations of the insured based on language in prior decisions from this court and from the Court of Appeals. In the Meyer case and in the Rebernick case, both cited in our brief, the court articulated what an insured expects, what a policyholder expects when they buy an umbrella policy. They call their agent, they say, I need an umbrella policy, please make it $2 million. Presumably, that's what happened. This court has said that insureds expect umbrella policies to confer coverage that's coextensive with the underlying policy, and that umbrella policies typically confer UM and UIM coverage, at least in this state, until recently when the legislature mandated that the insurance company had to at least offer it. So that's based on that precedent, I think The natural expectations of the insured is that coverage coextensive with the underlying policy exists. And if we look at the underlying facts here, now no one will know what went through Mr. Wadzinski's mind when he bought this policy. But it strikes me as unusual that a man who buys millions of dollars in insurance coverage to protect against liability that might be owed to others by himself or his company would leave his family and himself with $150,000 in UM coverage. That doesn't square with my concept of reality. Even more to the point, in the Etter case, for example, an agent came forward with an affidavit that said, we offered UM coverage to the Etter family and they declined it. Here we have no affidavit from any agent or from anyone familiar with how this policy was sold suggesting that UM coverage was offered or not. The Justice Prosser, did you?
Well, finish your point.
It circles back to my point, which is the in response to Justice Rogan's question, which is the problem I have with the format of this policy. A policy declarations page typically lists the coverages, period. This declarations page listed nothing. It listed $2 million, limits of liability. Limits of liability is a term that equally applies to liability coverage and UM coverage and UIM coverage. It applies to first party and third party coverages. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
The automobile liability underlying policy, that's where the uninsured motorist coverage is?
Yes.
And it's $150,000?
Correct.
Okay, but the liability in that policy is $500,000.
I don't think that's accurate. I think we have the underlying policy in the appendix, and I haven't.
Page 20.
Yeah, that would be, are you going off of the red one?
It's red brief, I'm sorry.
What I'm trying to say is I think, and I'm just going by memory here, but I think that the minimum underlying limits they required, a $500,000 single limit, was actually different than what the underlying policy, the primary policy, actually insured against. The primary policy is in our appendix at... Page 71 of our appendix, volume 1.
Auto insurance 1, yeah.
And that is a prototypical declarations page, a declarations page that lists the various coverages. So we have a combined liability coverage of, I think, $1 million in this case. Now, at one point in time in briefing, auto owners talked about there being a question of whether the underlying policy was actually in force. There's a couple of points I wish to make on that. Number one, it's probably an inappropriate argument based on the pleadings, because to the extent that keeping an underlying policy is in place as a condition precedent, it has to be pleaded with particularity, and I don't think the answer here can be construed to do that. But more to the point, the underlying policy, whether it's in place or not, really doesn't affect the outcome of this case, because there is a passage in this policy at page 60 of our appendix that indicates that if you fail to maintain the underlying insurance, we shall be liable only to the extent we would have been liable had you complied. So I guess that's next year's war if the court affirms in this case. over what that means, but in this particular context, what it doesn't mean is that the plaintiff is out of court for failing to keep an underlying policy.
I'm trying to put myself in the position of a reasonable insured, and I'm on this page that is headed exclusion of personal injury to insureds.
Okay.
We do not cover personal injury to you, me, right, or a relative.
Right.
But then we will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided in an underlying policy listed in Schedule A.
Right.
And we then go to Schedule A, and I see automobile liability and comprehensive personal liability. And, you know, I do know that this is a policy, I think it's $2 million.
This umbrella is $2 million, yes.
Okay. So this is much greater than anything in Schedule A.
That's true.
Okay. So what is my reasonable expectation of what the uninsured or underinsured coverage will be?
The underlying coverage or the coverage on the umbrella?
The coverage that is going to flow from we will cover such injury to the extent
the underlying coverage would be $2 million for uninsured motorist coverage, less any subtraction from that coverage. If, for example, the primary policy carries a reducing clause, that would apply, because we will cover such injury to the extent that an insurance is provided by an underlying policy in Schedule A. You may be wondering if...
Wait a minute. Am I misunderstanding you? You're asking for $2 million?
I'm asking for $2 million in coverage. I don't think that's an issue before this court now, because that's not been briefed. It's not been articulated. I think when I said that's next year's war, I think what will happen is auto owners will come into court and they will have I don't want to anticipate what they're going to say, but I suspect it's going to be less than $2 million. And they're going to argue that somehow or other either $500,000 is the limit for this UM coverage or not. Does that answer your question?
How is that my reasonable expectation?
When the insured calls up and says, I'd like $2 million in umbrella coverage, they're expecting $2 million in umbrella coverage. That's what this court has wrestled with over the years with the reducing clause cases. Because the reducing clause, I think this court has unanimously said at times, is counter to the insured's natural and reasonable expectations. So when somebody calls up and says, I'd like $2 million in coverage on an umbrella, they don't expect $500,000. They expect $2 million.
Well, the insurance company is arguing here they get nothing.
Yes.
Under insurance. Not $500,000, not $2 million.
They're arguing that this endorsement that we've been talking about should have been clearly understood by the average policyholder to confer nothing, even though they used the word insurance instead of liability insurance, even though they used the words following form. And I hesitate to get into this because it's just a morass, but the first sentence is illegal under Wisconsin law in that endorsement. We do not cover personal injury to you or a relative. That violates 632.32, subpart 6, subpart B, because that statute says you have to provide coverage to the named insured. So where does that...
You just said that wasn't the question when you started out saying that isn't the question for us today about whether they had to provide coverage. That's how you started your argument. Now you're telling us it's illegal because they're saying they're not providing coverage. You lost me on that one.
Oh, it's important because it relates to how you read this endorsement. If you read this endorsement to say we do not cover personal injury to you or a relative, and that's illegal, the statutes tell us the court has to construe the policy as if that were absent. If the courts construe the policy as if that were absent, then what we have is personal injury to an insured following form. We will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided by an underlying policy listed.
I don't understand. I'm sorry. You've really lost me. Why do they have to? I thought you started out telling me you don't have to have UM coverage under this policy, and that wasn't an issue before.
I started out by saying we don't quarrel for purposes of this argument with the validity of 6.77, the insurance regulation the commissioner passed. And the reason we don't quarrel with it is because we don't take the position, as was taken in the Stone case, that by failing to offer UM coverage, auto owners has somehow violated a different statute. We say they not only offered UM coverage, but they sold it.
Well, let's step back a bit. Do you think they were obligated to offer it under this umbrella policy?
I think they probably were, but I don't need to go there for purposes of this court, and this court need not address the issue of whether the insurance commissioner had the power to circumvent this court's decision in Rieberneck and pass a regulation, promulgated regulation, that was directly contrary to the court's construction of a statute the legislature passed. A very significant question under administrative law and the power of administrative
agencies.
Right,
but don't you get to the same place by what you're arguing to us now, that the first sentence of the exclusion is illegal?
No, what I'm arguing is their first sentence to the exclusion, what they say is that what this exclusion means is we're just confirming that nothing that was done in the underlying policy, that no coverage that was conferred by the underlying policy is affected.
Right. I understand their argument. What I don't understand is you're saying the first sentence is illegal if we don't need to determine whether they had to offer UM coverage or not. That's kind of where you lost me.
It's illegal because the question for construction is whether this court is going to accept an insurer's argument that we meant to offer an illegal endorsement. We incorporated an illegal endorsement versus the reading that the Court of Appeals imposed on this endorsement. Between an illegal endorsement and a reasonably constructed endorsement, the choice should be easy.
Why is the endorsement illegal?
Because the endorsement says we do not cover personal injury to you or a relative. That's illegal because the omnibus statute, specifically 6.32.32.6b, says it's illegal. It says you cannot, in an auto policy, decline to provide coverage to a named insured, which is exactly what they do here.
Well, okay, and then what you're saying is, well, that's either is or is not ameliorated by the Commissioner of Insurance's rule, which says that umbrellas don't have to afford that kind of coverage, correct? Or offer that kind of
insurance,
coverage.
The insurance commissioner's rule says they don't have to provide, they don't have
right.
to offer it.
Right, okay.
But it doesn't have anything to do with whether this endorsement's legal or illegal.
Well, it may or may not, depending on how we interpret the rules in combination with the statutes. But I now understand your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to focus on that second sentence, in part because that's what I thought the case was about. We will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided by an underlying policy listed in Schedule A. What does the reasonable insured understand that to mean?
What the reasonable insured expects that to mean is if the coverage is afforded, if it's the type of coverage afforded in the auto policy under Schedule A, it's afforded here. I think the Court of Appeals had a very good explanation of that, and at the risk of being unable to find it quickly. This is in paragraph 17 of the court's decision. A reasonable insured could read that sentence as follows. If an underlying policy insures against the risk, so does the umbrella policy. That, I think that's the best way to rephrase that second sentence. I see my time is up, so unless the court has further questions, thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kurtz.
I just will briefly address some of the statements issued by counsel and quote some of the policy language I think is, or case law that I think is most applicable. First of all, the concept that an exclusion cannot be part of an endorsement is what I think I heard, and I don't believe that's at all correct. Whether it's entitled an endorsement or exclusion, the first sentence of the particular exclusion we're talking about certainly is a limitation of coverage and or clarification of no coverage, which certainly is an exclusion.
Counsel, the second sentence seems to be an affirmative grant. How do you, I mean, because it says we will cover,
yeah.
How do you interpret that second sentence? What's your argument of how a reasonable insured would interpret this second sentence?
I think a reasonable insured interpreting that particular sentence would turn to Schedule A of the particular policy, see that the required coverage is for liability coverage only, does not include any reference at all to uninsured motorist coverage, and would have no expectation that this particular $2 million policy provides $2 million in umbrella coverage, as opposing counsel argues.
Well, would a reasonable... Well, I understood your argument to be a little bit different. I understood, at least according to the Court of Appeals and the way they understood your argument of what that sentence means, I'm referring to paragraph 16 of the Court of Appeals opinion. The endorsement's second sentence could read as clarifying the first sentence, which plainly excludes coverage for personal injury to an insured, has no effect on coverage available to the underlying policy. This interpretation appears to be a reasonable reading of the words. That's what they understood your interpretation to mean, and now you're telling me it's not that.
That is what we argued both to the Court of Appeals and to you. But then when I look at your follow-up question, okay, how else could, and, you know, looking at it from the vantage point of the insured, looking at it for an interpretation other than mine, how else could it be interpreted? And that's how I'm answering the question.
But you stand, I'm sorry, go ahead. Let's stay with your initial interpretation. That is that the endorsement's second sentence could read as clarifying that the first sentence, which plainly excludes coverage, has no effect on coverage available pursuant to an underlying policy. My question is, why would an insurer or an insured or anyone else believe that an exclusion in an umbrella policy could have any effect whatsoever on coverage in an underlying policy? That makes no sense to me.
So your question is why would that be included in the policy?
Yeah, my question is the very same that the Court of Appeals set forth in paragraph 16. We question why an insurer or anyone else would believe that an exclusion in an umbrella policy could have any effect on the coverage in an underlying policy. And their question resonates with me, but yet that seems to be your interpretation. So can you answer that question?
The answer is it just clarifies. It's an attempt to clarify. It does nothing more than that. I don't understand the harm or the concern that the court has in regards to that. It is a clarification. But even if you go to the other direction, even if you go to the Court of Appeals, in their decision. They don't, in their decision, don't reference Schedule A. When you look at Mullenbein and you look at Etter, they clearly, and the Court of Appeals clearly recognized a couple things. One, that this policy was a liability umbrella policy. That's what the granted coverage is. That's what they indicated. Similar to Mullenbein, we consider first the kind of coverage afforded by the policy. The umbrella policy is a liability policy. It states, and then it talks about the coverage provision, which is in essence the same as the one in the auto owner policy.
Counsel, with regard to Schedule A,
yes,
it refers not to coverage but to policies. Type of policy. The automobile liability policy. It's my understanding that all automobile liability policies under 632.32 have to have UM coverage.
That would be absolutely correct.
So any automobile liability policy necessarily has UM as opposed to UIM or some other stuff. Is that correct?
This policy, in this case, in looking at Mullenbein, this argument was made by other insureds in other cases that we've cited and rejected by the courts. The mere fact that the underlying policy is required to have UM coverage does not make UM coverage mandated, required, or covered under an umbrella policy.
It may not make it mandated, but it goes to what's the expectation of the reasonable insured. We're not dealing with coverage under Schedule A. We're dealing with what kind of policy you have. And all auto policies have to have UM coverage.
I have a red light here, so I will...
You may answer the question.
I will answer the question. I believe that Justice Prosser would like a follow-up question as well.
I'll give him that opportunity, and you too.
Okay. I believe it's clear that under Wisconsin law, umbrella policies are not mandated to have UM coverage. That's one. Two is because you reference a underlying policy but not the coverage, when you look at your Schedule A, the same thing that's in the Mullenbein case where it talks specifically, in this case, West Bend required ServiceMaster to carry comprehensive automobile liability insurance with a 500 CSL, combined single limit. That didn't result in a finding by the court that, therefore, there's UM coverage because the underlying policy has to have it. It references specifically, in that case, just like the auto owner's policy did, the liability coverage, not the UM coverage in the schedule.
On page 20 of the appendix.
Which appendix? Red.
I believe Mr. Kurtz's appendix. Under underlying carrier schedule.
Yes.
The executive policy is an auto owner's policy. Do the underlying carriers have to be auto owners?
Absolutely not. An umbrella, oftentimes they are, and obviously the insurer would prefer that they sell both the underlying policy as well as the umbrella policy, but it is not mandated in this policy or in my experience. I'd say 95% of the times from what I've seen policies, the underlying carrier is also the umbrella carrier, but it is not 100%. I have seen some.
But now let's say the auto owner's liability policy listed in Schedule A had been issued by Progressive. Would you have changed the language on page 31?
I don't believe so, because, again...
Because it says we, I would think that would be auto owners, will cover such injury to the extent that insurance issued by Progressive is provided in an underlying policy?
It says by an underlying policy. It doesn't say our underlying policy. I don't believe that there would be any distinction between whether it's the same insurer or not.
Probably good practice for the insured to get policies from the same company so that you don't have conflicting provisions. Whereas if the same company sells you both policies and they conflict, tough on them. If you have an underlying policy that conflicts with the umbrella, then it may be tough on the insured.
Again, I think that makes sense. Obviously, any particular two policies would have to be looked at. You would hope that it would be easier if both policies, that there wouldn't have be that type of construction issues.
But my question is this. The underlying policy, if it had been issued by Progressive, there's an underinsured motorist coverage in that policy.
There would be in every underlying.
Okay. We will cover such injury to the extent that insurance is provided by an underlying policy.
They're talking specifically about the coverage provided under the umbrella policy covering in addition to or above the underlying policy. That's the purpose and essence of a umbrella policy. It sits on top, provides additional umbrella coverage, but it's obviously limited to the coverage that's sold.
Well, I don't know that that is in your favor, that construction.
I'm not certain how you interpret it. I am.
You meant it.
You know my position, and I appreciate the time that you've given me. And
let me just ask you this then. On page 19 of your brief.
Which brief?
The red brief.
The initial one?
Initial.
Thank
yes.
you.
And this is where you say the meaning of the second sentence is plain. Right? Do you see that?
Yes.
The plain meaning is this to you, which is what I think the Court of Appeals said. Although the executive umbrella policy does not cover first-party claims, and that's your basic position.
Correct.
If the insured has coverage for first-party injuries under an underlying policy, no matter who gave it, right, auto owners will still provide such coverage under that policy. What does that mean?
I think that's meant, and that it's the assumption is that auto owners provide the underlying policy.
Right.
And I think the language would be that it doesn't undermine the coverage under that policy, whether it's an auto owner's policy or another.
So what I understood that sentence to mean is, you are not, by this umbrella policy, changing the underlying auto policy, which includes uninsured motorists.
That's exactly what it was intended to be meant. But again, I think it was loosely worded because in preparing this particular sense, we didn't consider the fact that there is a possibility that the underlying coverage is issued by a third party.
But it seems as if your principle remains the same. The umbrella remains over all of the underlying policies and provides excess monetary coverage for the same kind of claims as the underlying. And that's your point.
That is correct.
If we were to decide in opposing counsel's favor today, is there any question about whether $2 million is due or perhaps another $150,000, which is the underlying coverage?
I will give you my unresearched, unreviewed
Great.
Opinion for what it's worth. I would believe it would be very hard-pressed for us to argue that the coverage is anything other than $2 million.
Okay.
I don't think I'm creative enough, at least standing here today, without looking at something to come up with a different opinion.
Because that would fly in the face of your definition of umbrella.
Exactly.
Well, what does the $500,000 mean then?
That is the two underlying policies' liability limits.
Got it.
Not UM limits.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. Have a great day.
We want to thank you, Mr. Kurtz, and you, Mr. Burnett, for your arguments today on yet another insurance policy and whether it is or isn't ambiguous and whether it is or isn't what it means. Sort of in more recent cases, we've come to interpret not only the underlying policies, but what umbrella policies mean. We haven't had too many of those in prior years. So thank you for your helpful briefs and your helpful arguments. That concludes our argument 09AP2752, Wadzinski versus Auto Owners Insurance Company. The court is in recess for lunch until 1:30. Justice Prasa will meet with any students who are still left. There are no students. Nothing personal.
You get no respect.
Okay, we're back at 1:30.